And it was at that moment that I realized it wasn't that the sport didn't do anything by itself. It's the lifestyle that I adopted by doing the sport. And then I realized that tied everything together right there, mind, body, and spirit, all in that one moment.
Hello, I'm Jeff Zankoff, the Tri-Doc, an emergency physician, triathlete, triathlon coach, and multiple Ironman finisher. And this is the March 22nd, 2024 episode of the Tri-Doc Podcast, coming to you as always from beautiful, sunny Denver, Colorado. There's a lot of interesting pieces and bits of information coming out of the world of triathlon of late, most of it originating from the world of Ironman. First of those things has to do with the new rules involving no more bottles down the jerseys of Ironman participants. The second of those has to do with, of course, the new My Ironman website that looks like, I think, kind of an interesting repository of information that you can go to and sign up for and see all of your previous results as well as your races that you're registered for in the upcoming years. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about either of those things. I think both of them have been covered pretty extensively elsewhere, including by my good friend Matt Sharp over at The Tempo. And speaking of Matt, well, that's really what I want to dedicate the rest of the beginning intro of this episode to, because Matt joined me last week for a bonus episode for my Patreon supporters. And if you are a said supporter of this podcast, then you've already had access to that episode. But if you're not, I wanted to give you a little bit of a sample of what you are missing out on and perhaps encourage you to consider becoming a supporter, just like Justin Raphael, who decided for about the price of a cup of coffee every month, he wanted to come on board and support this podcast so that I can continue to make it a better show that can deliver to you the high quality programming that you are used to, and doing so with increasingly advanced technology, bringing you better sounding shows every couple of weeks on the interwebs. Justin has availed himself of the latest bonus episode, and you can as well if you sign up. If you sign on at the $10 per month level, you'll also get a thank you gift in the form of a BOCO Tri-Doc Podcast running hat. But even if you join in at the $5 per month level, you're going to get yourself all of the available bonus episodes that stretch back since I began doing this program back in 2018. And as I said, the most recent episode included a really extensive interview with Matt Sharp. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, and we had a discussion about the recent T100 race that took place in Miami. Here's what Matt had to say about that in that bonus episode that came out last week.
Yeah, I mean, from a pure racing standpoint, I thought it was interesting. When you get these good athletes on the start line, it's always going to be good action. So yeah, I thought the racing was quite good. With the broadcasts and even just stuff like the timing of the race, the women we saw in pitch black conditions at some point during their race. So yeah, in terms of the racing, I quite enjoyed it. I'm a huge fan of the sport. So that's just me, my personal opinion. But yeah, definitely think of the PTO or the T100, sorry, as like almost like a startup series. It definitely lived up to that in terms of just iterating, hopefully iterating on previous mistakes as they progress through the season.
I guess this is the thing that I keep coming kind of stumbling over is they're not a startup anymore. They've been around now for several years. They've had a lot. They brought to the table this time a really good play-by-play announcer in the form, I don't know his name, but finally somebody who actually could do a really good job, which is something Ironman still refuses to do. They don't have anybody. They continue to stick with Mike Lovato, who I think has shown remarkable improvement, but is still nowhere close to a really good play-by-play guy. And Rinny, I just don't think Rinny does a great job. Just because you're a professional doesn't mean you're going to have a good microphone presence. It doesn't mean you're going to give valuable insights. And I find that too many professional triathletes do the same thing. They just describe what we're seeing on camera. Over and over again, I found myself going, why are you telling me exactly what I'm looking at? I don't need that. I want insights. And I didn't find that Rinny did a good job of that. But the other thing, and just the bigger thing, is just going back to this idea that the PTO is starting over and they should know better. And I don't feel like they're starting over. I feel like they've been doing this for a while. And to have a race that goes dark because they started late and somebody smacking their head going, why didn't we think of that? It's like, I don't know. I just feel like they should be better than that at this point. Or am I just missing something?
I think we all want it to be better. It's more like, what do we want? Well, everybody wants the series to succeed, I think, at the end of the day, and bring more attention to our sport and the incredible professionals who are at the pointy end of these races. So it's more, I think people are just feeling like they want it to succeed so badly. But the reality is, like, these guys are doing a lot of these races for the first time at these different locations with all the different logistics in terms of permits and, yeah, everything logistically that comes with that. And to be honest, like, I think we all have to, in a way, lower our expectations with that stuff in mind. Honestly, if they can get through this year and just pull off all the races, finally announce where they're going to do the grand final, that will be a success. But it's more like, okay, these guys are, I have a lot of empathy for them trying to do this. So I try and not point too many flaws. I mean, there is flaws, of course, but for me, I just want them to succeed. And I guess at the end of the day, any feedback is going to be positive feedback for them to iterate on. And who knows, maybe by the end of the year, you know, they're going to have the better graphics. The commentators are all going to be, you know, a little more dialed. I think to have expectations of, especially someone like Rini just jumping on the mic for 4 or 5 hours or however long it is, and then spitting out all these incredible insights. I know I couldn't do that. So for me, it's going to be more at the end of the season, what do things look like versus now? And if they are measurably and demonstrably better, then I think it will be seen as a success.
So there you have it. Just a small portion of the much longer interview that I had with Matt. We went on to discuss a whole host of other topics, including the professional series that's coming with the Ironman branded races, as well as several other things. And of course, the Tempo, Matt's very successful triathlon newsletter. If you're not a subscriber, you really should be. Again, you can get yourself this bonus episode and all of the other bonus episodes that are available to my Patreon supporters if you consider signing on to become a subscriber. You can see what's involved in doing that if you head on over to my Patreon site, which is www.patreon.com/TriDocPodcast. And as always, a thank you in advance just for considering. On the show today, we have a really interesting medical mailbag for you. A question was submitted by a longtime listener by the name of Richard Rees, who wanted to know what the effects are of alcohol, not so much on training, but on sleep. I've actually covered the subject of alcohol way back in episode 27. That was all the way back in December of 2019. I discussed at that time the effects that alcohol have on training and on just your overall well-being in general. But Richard wanted to know specifically, do small amounts of alcohol have an impact on sleep, and whether or not that has an impact on our ability to recover and then train well the next day? Well, this was an excellent question, something that I hadn't really gone into in detail way back when I first talked about alcohol. And so Coach Juliet Hockman and I are going to have a deeper dive into this subject specifically in the medical mailbag, and that's coming up very shortly. A little bit later on, I'm joined by Nick Klingensmith. Nick's not a triathlete, but he is an endurance athlete, and he's one of several athletes who I've met lately who have a story to tell, and that story is one of personal trials and tribulations and one of redemption, and that redemption came in the form of finding endurance sport. Nick, in his case, didn't really find triathlon the way so many of us have, but he did find marathon running, ultra running, and eventually Spartan racing. And through that has really rediscovered his love of life and his love of family, and has dealt with a lot of health issues along the way, and has a story to tell that I think we can all learn from and all find ourselves in just a little bit. Even if we haven't gone through the depths of personal issues that Nick did, I know that we'll all see ourselves just a little bit in his own story. And I think it's an excellent story that he told me, and I look forward to sharing it with you all. And that's coming up just a little bit later on. I know that you're going to enjoy this episode, so let's get right to it with the medical mailbag. Juliet, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm well. If Juliet's here, it can only mean one thing. It's time for the medical mailbag. That's right, that time on the podcast when we answer a question that often, increasingly, is submitted by one of our listeners, and that is the case today. Juliet, what do we have? I should formally introduce you, of course. Coach Juliet Hockman of Life Sport Coaching, a friend and a colleague. She is in possession of this episode's reader question. What do we have?
I am. And thank you to Richard, who sent this question in. It's a terrific one. He asks, your discussions over the festive break, in other words, the holiday break, reignited a question that I've had for a while. It is clear, and evidence-based, that consuming, quote, a lot of alcohol significantly affects almost all metrics of sleep in a detrimental way. But is that the case for, quote, unquote, moderate amounts? How much is too much? What would be the impact of a glass of wine with dinner, or a beer after work, or a small whiskey at the end of the evening? Sleep is clearly the ultimate performance-enhancing drug, but as most of your listeners are juggling work, family, and other aspects of life alongside their triathlon goals, is there any peer-reviewed data we can use to inform our lifestyle choices? Thanks for that very well-worded question, Richard. We had to read the whole thing because it was so good.
Yeah, I agree. It really was a great question. And it prompted us to do a little bit of a deep dive because I have discussed alcohol before a couple of times. I did a deep dive on alcohol and its impact on training performance specifically, but that was quite a while ago and I didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about sleep at that time. And I originally answered Richard that I said I wasn't entirely sure if there was a lot of evidence on sleep, and it turns out there is. There's actually quite a bit, and it's not great, as we're about to hear. And it's interesting, right? Because I know you and I were talking just before we started recording, like I will often come home after a long shift. I finish at midnight sometimes. And if I've had a really squirrely shift where I was really being tasked with some pretty challenging sick patients, I come home, I'm wired. And it's really hard for me to like turn my brain off and go to sleep. And I'll pour myself a glass of scotch and have that glass of scotch while I just kind of unwind a little bit, knowing that the alcohol is going to help me fall asleep. And I think you were saying that that's something that you've done before, right?
100%. I mean, I have worked from home since the beginning of the pandemic, and I have found more and more frequently that right around 5:30, I'm beginning to get a little bit of bored sitting at my desk. I might go and pour myself a glass of wine, have my little cheese and crackers. We've talked about that before too. And that will kind of get me through the last 90 minutes or so of work that I have to get done on the day before I pack it in for the evening and go make dinner or whatever. And I found it was getting more and more frequent. I would be having just a glass, but still a glass of wine every night.
Yeah, and we found some really interesting studies, a bunch of them, and they all kind of showed kind of the same thing, that alcohol, I think everybody knows inherently that you have a drink of alcohol, it doesn't really mean it matter what, it could be a beer, it could be a glass of wine, it could be a glass of scotch, but whatever it is, it makes you feel tired, and in fact, it does help you fall asleep. There's good research that drinking alcohol decreases what's called the latency time to sleep, basically the time between lying down and actually falling asleep. So alcohol works to help you fall asleep, which is kind of why I think it's become one of the top sleep aids. I was quite fascinated to see this, that alcohol is used as a sleep aid by more people than anything else, which I thought was really interesting. Unfortunately, it's what it does to your sleep is really important, and what we're going to kind of chat about here. The first paper we found was titled Alcohol Dependence and Its Relationship with Insomnia and Other Sleep Disorders. And this comes from 2016. And it looked principally at people who had alcohol use disorder. So these are people who have some degree of alcohol dependency. But there is definite implications for people without alcohol dependency. And I think the most important thing here is they talk about moderate alcohol use as anybody drinking less than 1 gram per kilogram of alcohol. So that doesn't probably mean anything, right? So let's think of an average 70 kilogram person. That means that 1 gram per kilogram means 70 grams of alcohol. So just to give you a sense of what we're talking about, wine is 13% alcohol by volume. So you have to do some fancy mathematics to figure out exactly how many milliliters you need to get 75 grams. But take my word for it, it's 100 milliliters. You don't have to drink much wine to get 75 grams of alcohol.
Okay.
And that would qualify you in this paper as moderate alcohol intake. Okay. Now, With alcohol use disorder, it's more than just taking that in. It's actually taking it in on a regular basis. But whatever. That's. I just want to point out that heavy alcohol use is more than a gram per kilogram, so more than 100 milliliters of wine. And less is going to be less. Moderate and less alcohol use is going to be less than a gram per kilogram or less than 100 mils of wine. Now, remember, whatever you're drinking is going to change the calculus. So a beer is much less. It's only about, depending on what beer you're drinking, it could be anywhere from 4 to 6% of alcohol by volume, and spirits are going to be up to 40%. So you have to drink much less. At any rate, if we look at what these papers have found, it's been shown pretty clearly that when you drink alcohol, and I was fascinated to see that it almost doesn't matter when you drink the alcohol. Now, clearly, the closer you drink the alcohol to sleep, the more impact it has on your sleep. But you could drink the alcohol fairly remotely. As long as there's some alcohol left in your system, it actually has a pretty big impact on the architecture of sleep. And the big thing it does is it decreases REM sleep. So although it may help you fall asleep quicker, the quality of your sleep is dramatically decreased because your REM sleep is much less. You're also having much less of what's called slow wave sleep, which is sort of that deep sleep. So you're in a lighter state of sleep. You're not having any REM movement, which means you're not dreaming, which means you're not having the true reset of the brain, the recovery of the brain that sleep is so important for. And other findings in this paper related to people who are drinking a lot and drinking on a regular basis, they're sleeping much less, sleeping less than 6 hours a night, which we know is linked with all kinds of long-term health issues, including cardiometabolic, psychiatric problems, things like that. But that again, that's alcohol use disorder. That's not just like the occasional drink. So I don't want to suggest that the occasional drink is associated with those things. But you know, what they found is that there's evidence to suggest that even moderate alcohol use is harmful to sleep patterns, even in healthy individuals without alcohol use disorder. By decreasing REM sleep duration, decreasing sleep architecture and efficiency, both of which are so important to healthy rest. And as Richard alluded to in his question, so vital for us to be able to recover properly and be able to train well the next day. So we found another paper that looked at non-alcoholic social drinkers. And once again, they found pretty much the same thing. Drinking small amounts of alcohol, even less than a gram per kilogram, so less than that glass of wine, clearly reduces the time to fall asleep, but then lowers the quality of sleep, decreases REM sleep, decreases these deep sleep, and also tends to make the latter half of the night of sleep much less, lower quality, and people tend to sleep less. We found a third paper, this one called The Effects of Alcohol on Sleep and Nocturnal Heart Rate, Relationships to Intoxication and Morning After Effects. This one was a pretty interesting paper because they made people drink a lot. But what they found was these people, not only did they have poor sleep quality, but they had much higher heart rates. They slept on average 15 minutes less than people who had not had any alcohol, and their sleep efficiency and sleep quality was significantly affected. So just across the board, quite a bit of research that shows really small amounts of alcohol can have a pretty major impact on sleep quality. Now, you know, I'm not going to stop having a drink every once in a while. Sure. I don't tend to drink a lot during training season. I mean, I've said this before. I mean, once we roll over into January or so, when I start training in earnest, I tend to shut off the drinking, except for on occasion. And I'm not going to just not drink ever again. I enjoy drinking wine. I enjoy having a beer every once in a while. I enjoy my scotch, but I'm going to take this into account. And I'm certainly, if I'm tired, I'm not going to use alcohol to help me get to sleep, that's for sure. And I'm definitely going to be conscious of this. If I'm sleep deprived, be careful about alcohol, because you want that quality of sleep to be better. And I know you, Juliet, were telling me about your own personal experience. What
right.
Was that?
I was going to say, we sort of know this, right? We know this intellectually, that regardless of what age you are, you do sort of tend to wake up later in the night. And I think that if you overlay on the top of this both age, right, it gets harder as you get older, I think, for men and women. But then particularly for women, once you hit sort of 50, 55, drinking's or menopause's effect on drinking and sleep can be brutal. And I know anecdotally from a number of my friends, I'm 57, and many of my friends are the same age, that it's just not worth it anymore. As much as we love our wine or we love our cocktail, we love that drink in the evening socially or not socially, it's not worth it at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. It increases all of the menopausal symptoms that happen at night, or it seems to. And what we were talking about right before the show started was that last November, I was sort of looking down the barrel of several different surgeries that I had to undergo. And I thought, okay, I'm going to give my body the best possible chance at recovering. And so November 1, I just stopped drinking altogether. And again, I was probably having a glass of wine a night, or maybe 5 or 6 nights a week. And the first few nights, I really missed it a lot, I won't lie to you. But then I noticed its impact on sleep quality, not having that drink, was profound. And instead of waking up several times a night, which I think is fairly typical for women my age, it was sort of once a night. And it reminded me of having a newborn, when you get that baby from waking up every hour or waking up several times a night to just once a night. It's so easy. You think, oh, I can do this for the rest of my life. It was sort of the same sort of feeling. And so I haven't gone back to it. And I like my glass of white wine, red wine. I love a beer in the summer, et cetera. For me, it just hasn't been worth it to go back to it, because I'm enjoying sleeping as much as I am since November 1 of last year.
It's interesting, because when I read this paper, the thing I thought of was, well, I mean, everybody knows if you drink, a gram per kilogram, of course you're not going to sleep, because you're going to wake up to go pee.
Right.
But they don't even talk about that. And I should just say, the reason you wake up to go pee is because alcohol is a diuretic.
Sure.
It's an osmotic diuretic. What that means is that your kidneys filter it out and it draws a lot of water along with it, and it makes you wanna, it fills up your bladder and you're gonna have to go pee. I mean, that's just, we all know that. And I thought that was what this paper was gonna say. And in fact, no, it doesn't even comment on that. It doesn't talk about how you're gonna wake up to go pee. It talks instead about how your sleep architecture is so badly impacted and is so poor. I mean, waking up to pee is just compounding that problem. But the other thing it makes me think about, because, you know, you and I both have said that we both kind of cut out alcohol, and but we both still will drink on occasion. And it reminds me, we've had conversations about the benefits, right? We've talked about the French paradox and about how there's pretty good evidence about how red wine contains some pretty important chemicals that are really beneficial. And we've also, I have talked previous to you joining me, I've talked about the reverse J curve for alcohol, where as you increase the amount of alcohol you take from zero, you actually see some benefits to cardiovascular health. But then eventually, too much alcohol, you start to see some negative health consequences. But there are clearly some benefits, both to cardiovascular health and even to certain cancers, to having a low amount of alcohol every day. But, well, probably not every day, but certainly on a regular basis. And I just find it really interesting. We have this study that clearly shows even small amounts of alcohol are bad for sleep. But then I have, on the other hand, I have these studies that say, well, small amounts of alcohol are actually really good for your health. So you know, it's really hard to put it all together. And I'm a physician who's read all the science, and I don't really have a good way to recommend it. And instead, I think I find, because Richard's question was, how do we inform these busy people who have a lifestyle, these lifestyle choices, how do they make them? And you know what I come back to is, I'm like, you know what? If this is something you enjoy, if you're going to have dinner with your spouse or your partner and you want to have a beer or a glass of wine, you know what? Have at it.
100%.
I think that this is just one of those examples where there is no cut and dry. Yeah. Is it going to impact your sleep? Yeah, it is. But you know what? You're going to get the benefits of the red wine and the benefits of the alcohol, right? So it's really hard to come down and say you shouldn't drink at all. Now, there are going to be those people who don't drink at all. And to them, I say, well, there's no reason to start. So,
right. I mean, I think it's a judgment-free, completely personal decision, right? I'll go and I'll sit there with a beautiful glass of Oregon Red, and I'll look at it and I'll think, oh, this is going to taste so good. And then I'll think, oh, this is going to suck at 3 a.m. So it just maybe it's worth it that particular night, or maybe it's just not. But I do think about it now, whereas 20 years ago, I wouldn't have thought about it at all. So I think it's not only that it alcohol, without a doubt, disturbs sleep, but then the other part is, once it has disturbed your sleep, are you lying there staring at the ceiling, worrying about 27,000 different things, which is a whole other story. So it's a completely personal choice, and people will do what they do, for sure. I don't think we're judging anybody here.
Absolutely judgment-free zone, for sure. I guess I just sort of struggle with what to answer Richard. I mean, the easy answer to his question is yes, alcohol impacts sleep. Even small amounts of alcohol will have a detrimental effect on sleep and therefore potentially impact your ability to train the next day. However, it doesn't mean you shouldn't drink. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy your drink, because he asked specifically about the fact that we're all busy people. We're all trying to balance, juggle so many things, and with so many balls in the air. Listen, it's just like we talked about eating, right? We talked about how food is a joy. We should all enjoy the fact that food is a pleasure. I went this past weekend. I went to one of my favorite restaurants and didn't have a reservation. Just kind of went on a whim and just, you can never get into this place. It's called La Française in Breckenridge. Wonderful French restaurant owned by a family from Saint-Tropez in France. Just amazing food. We can never get in unless we have a reservation. But I walked up and I said, I know you won't have a table, but just in case, I thought I would check. And they said, we had a no-show. And so we got to go in, and it was me and my twins, and we sat down and we were so excited, and I ate the worst possible food. I had butter on butter on butter.
I love it.
It was fantastic, and I enjoyed all of it, and I savored it. I didn't have a glass of wine with my meal. I wish I had, kind of, but I just, you know what? It's guilt-free, because it was I haven't eaten like that in a long time, and I'm not going to sit there and beat myself up over it, because I enjoyed it so much. I enjoyed the experience. I enjoyed being there with my kids, who enjoyed it. It was just a really nice evening. And that's what I think I tell Richard. It's like, yeah, is this going to impact your sleep? Yeah, but you know what? If you're really going to enjoy that glass of wine or that glass of scotch or whatever it is, you know what? It's a fair trade. And life is short, so take advantage of the things that you enjoy, and just understand that, yeah, maybe you're not going to sleep quite as well that night. Don't do it every night, but you know what? It's okay to do once in a while.
I really look at it as something to look forward to now. Instead of just assuming I'll have my glass at 5:30 or 6 o'clock every night, it's more, oh, hey, I'm going to see Jeff at camp in May. It'll be really fun to share a beer with Jeff at camp. Or my sister's coming out to visit me for a week. I live in the heart of Oregon's wine growing and beer producing area. Darn straight, I'm going to take her to all my favorite places and introduce her to all my favorite beers and wines. So it's really something more to look forward to, rather than just, I'll have a glass of wine because it's 5:30. So I guess that's the choice that I make now.
I think that really, yeah, makes a ton of sense. And I think, like we said before, everybody has to make their own kind of judgment and balance. And as long as it's healthful and informed, that's really all that matters. So, well, there we go. We've put another question to rest. I'm really excited that we're starting to get more and more listener questions like Richard's. And if you have a question that you want to hear us answer here on the Medical Mailbag, I hope that you will send it to us. You can do so by sending me an email at tri_doc@icloud.com. You can actually do what Richard did, which was go to my TriDoc Coaching website at tri.coaching.com. That's a first, and very much appreciated. He used the contact form on there to reach out to me. You can also join the private Facebook page the private Facebook group for the TriDoc podcast. Just search for the TriDoc podcast on Facebook. Answers the three easy questions. I'll grant you admittance, and you can join the conversation and ask your questions there. However you do it, we are excited to have you on board and answer your question as soon as we can. Juliet, thank you again for joining me today. This was another fun conversation, and I'll look forward to answering more questions on the next episode.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Yeah! You may have noticed on the podcast of late that not all of the guests are necessarily high-profile members of our triathlon community. Recently, I have tried very hard to bring in a lot of new voices, people who have stories to tell, either because they themselves are age groupers within our sport and have experienced things where their lives and triathlon have intersected in positive ways, or, as is the case today, somebody who has not done a triathlon, at least not yet, but has a story to tell because endurance sport has played a very important role in their life. Today's guest is Nick Klingensmith. Nick has a story that begins with being thrown out of a Las Vegas hotel in a drunken haze that jeopardized his career and relationships, and he realized at that point that he had to make a change. He is a four-time cancer survivor, a type 1 diabetic, a recovering alcoholic with herniated discs, nerve damage, and sleep apnea. And he goes on to defy all of those things when he discovers obstacle course racing. He refused to accept his limitations and went on to complete over 100 Spartan races, 6 marathons, several ultras, and scores of other obstacle and endurance events. As someone who has walked the path of a sales professional, Nick is an expert in propelling other achievement-driven professionals and leaders to overcome fear and rejection and push past self-limiting doubts by inspiring them to take purposeful action toward their goals. Nick is a raw and passionate storyteller who holds nothing back when revealing who he used to be and the person he is now. And I know that his story is going to resonate with many of us in the triathlon world because many of us have also had stories, maybe perhaps not quite as dramatic, but definitely stories of redemption that we have found through multi-sport. So Nick, thank you so much for joining me on the TriDoc podcast. I look forward to sharing your story here with my listeners.
Thank you for having me.
Nick, why don't we begin first with, I guess, the lowest point. Tell us about what it is that got you to that hotel room in Las Vegas and what it was that made you realize that you were at a turning point and something had to change.
So I'll actually go a couple months before that happened. And it was actually around this time of year. And I remember I was out to happy hour with my girlfriend at the time and some people from work. And it was a simple night. We had a couple drinks and then my girlfriend and I went home. And I got a text message from my boss at the time. And he made a comment to me that other people were sort of talking trash about my behavior. And I was so infuriated by other people talking trash about my drinking that I decided I would stop drinking. And you can imagine that went really well since I was doing it for all the right reasons. And so I made this big declaration. I said, I'm going to quit drinking after the Super Bowl. And I just kind of kept this thing up. And I did. I did quit drinking for a period of about 3 or 4 months. And it was excruciating. Because I wasn't doing it with any sort of support group. I wasn't doing it for myself. I was just doing it because of other people's problems, not quite willing to address my own. And then this is about 2013, now into 2014. And then I went over to Moffitt Cancer Center, where I've been getting my cancer treatment for the better part of 10 years. And I was diagnosed with cancer for the third time in a decade. Only this time, and my previous cancers were all thyroid cancer. So they took out all the tissue, but yet there's still cells and lymph nodes and residual tissue. And that's what had happened here, is that the recurrence had happened on a lymph node, which was attached to my vocal cord behind a bunch of stuff. And so the doctors told me they didn't want to operate. They said that the risk would outweigh the reward, that the cancer wasn't very aggressive, and I should just stay with it. We looked at a couple different other medical options and they all said the same thing. And so a lot of times when I had cancer and been diagnosed with cancer over the years, I was scared, I was sad, I was angry, but not this time. This time I was relieved because now I could drink and be whatever sort of a douchebag I wanted. And I had this excuse that I could just slap right on my shoulder here that said, I have inoperable cancer. What are you going to do about it? And those were the couple months that led me to Vegas because I was still pretending not to drink, even though I was drinking. And at this point, even though I thought I was in control, it had completely taken over me. And there I was, July 12th, 2014. I'm in Vegas. I'm at a club. I'm hanging out with friends. And I am pretending that I'm having fun. I mean, Ja Rule is there. Everybody's jamming. And I was just white knuckling it because I was just so miserable without that crutch in my life. And so when everybody went to bed, I went back down to the bar and I just continued to drink and drink and drink until suddenly I found myself blacked out. I came to on the floor of my Las Vegas hotel, not my room, the actual hallway floor, surrounded by cops, surrounded by Vegas, by the security. And they were telling me that I had to leave because I had gotten in a fight. This made no sense to me. Even in my worst days, I wasn't a violent drunk. I was life of the party drunk. But here's the parts of the night that I do remember. On the other side of that door was my girlfriend, who I had put to bed. And about an hour before that, I had picked up a hooker who I tried to have sex with in a closet down the hall. You want to talk about low? We aren't even at the lowest moment yet. We're almost there because I'm still in this defending my actions. It's everybody else's fault type attitude. We got thrown out of the hotel and I had to wake my girlfriend up and I had to spin some story about how it's all bullshit. It wasn't my fault. And it took us several hours to find another room. And I mean, I was that drunk where it just, all you want to do is sleep. When we finally found a room and my head hit the pillow, I had this moment of lucidity. And I said, I don't want to live this way anymore. And that was the moment that it was probably the first healthy decision I had made for myself in the better part of forever. And that was 2014. That wasn't actually the moment that I decided to become an athlete or to get into sports. I just knew that I had to stop drinking. I had to stop being a slave to alcohol. And so I joined a program. And then there I was, 2 years sober. Now we're talking 2016. I was in a better spot in my life. I was actually dating a new girl, which is my now wife. I had just been promoted at work. And I had actually just had cancer for the fourth time, only this time it was a different cancer. It was in the back of my head and they took it out and I was given like an all clear. I was actually beaten cancer decisively and yet I was lost. And that's when my boss walked into my office on a Friday afternoon in October and he said, hey, I want you to do a Spartan race with me. I'm looking at him and I go, no, like 10-mile trail run, obstacles? I had no desire to be that uncomfortable. But that's when I realized I already was that uncomfortable. Something was missing in my life. I was ready to make that change. I was ready to start improving again.
I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people don't necessarily come to the conclusion they want to do something and challenge themselves coming from a position that you were in, certainly not that low. But a lot of people do kind of make these decisions to do these kinds of sporting events because they want to challenge themselves and because they want to prove something to themselves. Do you think that for you, there was something missing in your, like you say, something was missing? I often worry about people who come from a history of addiction that sport kind of fills that addiction in a way. Do you think that for you, that's been partly the case that you get in all into training, all into these like very, very hard endurance events and it kind of fulfills that addictive need?
I mean, I'm an addict, right? So regardless, I'm a feel-good junkie one way, shape, or form or another. But I mean, let's be honest. Sport, especially endurance sports, it's like 99.9% suffering for that 0.1% of feel-good moments. But, you know, it wasn't that it filled the void for me. What it did for me is it tied my worlds together. Because I had been in a program of recovery for 2 years. I had a spiritual program where I was developing the spiritual fitness part. My mental fitness is always progressing. And I was physical at the time. I was running some 5Ks. I was going to the gym. I was doing a few things. But what I wasn't doing is living my life purposefully and intentionally. And when I accepted the race, it's because I wanted to be all in. I did. I needed something. I just needed a direction, a rigid thing. It was only 9 weeks away. It wasn't like I was making a lifestyle change at the time. It was just, I'm going to run this one race. But with that became this series of small decisions. And the first one, the most life-changing thing I've ever done, was set the alarm for 5 a.m. to wake up before work to work out. I had been the guy my entire life who wakes up 29 seconds before I need to be somewhere. And I thought it was impossible for me to get up that early to train. And with that, though, all of a sudden, all these other good things started happening. Number one, I had more time with my dog in the morning. I was able to, by the time I got to work, I wasn't like rubbing out the eyes. I was already awake and alert. I was in a better mood. The endorphins were flowing. The blood was pumping. I was just better. But then if I wanted to consistently wake up at 5, I needed a bedtime. So I treated myself to the first ever regular sleep cycle in my entire life. And then as I kept going, though, I realized I need to be able to recover if I'm going to continue to train. So I started stretching at night and doing just a 30-minute range of motion, yin yoga, passive stretching routine. And with that, though, and this is the thing that tied it all together, that's when I started meditating because I wanted to become more mentally tough. And so my stretching routine became a meditative practice. And it was at that moment that I realized it wasn't that the sport didn't do anything by itself. It's the lifestyle that I adopted by doing the sport. And then I realized that tied everything together right there, mind, body, and spirit, all in that one moment.
I love the way you kind of came to those things on your own, because a lot of people are in endurance sport for years without figuring all of that out. And you kind of came to it all on your own, and very quickly too, the idea of apportioning your time in a way that you're going to be able to get things done, making that sacrifice of, hey, I'm going to change things and get up early and get this workout done, and then realizing very quickly the benefits of doing that and making these little tweaks to your lifestyle so that they don't necessarily adversely affect the rest of your life, and really configuring just minor little things that allow you to configure your life around this new kind of lifestyle. How long did it take for this to kind of set in as because you said it was a 9-week period leading up to this first race. How long did it take for this to become kind of like your habit?
So the race was on a Saturday. The next day, my wife and I, we spent the day out at Flagler Beach out by on the East Coast. And it was December. It was like perfect weather. It was 60-something. And I'm still wearing my first medal. And I felt this just feeling of serenity that I don't think I had ever felt in my life before. This true feeling of like peace and achievement, like just competent. Like I was just comfortable with myself. And so the very next day I went into the office, and again, this was signed up as a one and done, but I walked into my office, it might've been 8:05 AM by the time my boss and I hit the whiteboard and we started planning our year for the rest of the year. So what, 5 minutes? It was a 9-week process to do the one race. And then like that, it just became a lifestyle of what I did. And like you said, it was very quickly, because that decision, that was the middle of December. By March, there was actually supposed to be a Spartan race in Cuba. And so I had signed up for it. And by the time the race had come, unfortunately, they had to cancel the race. And so we went to Cuba anyway. And we were there for about 4 days. And I don't know if you've been to Cuba, but all the good Cuban food is in Miami. And because everything over there is bland, there's no spices. It's poor, it's desolate, like literally farm to table. And so we ate like just good, simple, organic food. And when I came home that Monday, I was like, man, I can't wait to eat it, just a greasy pizza. And we did. And I felt sick for like 3 days. And at that moment, I was like, again, it's all these small incremental changes, right? I was like, I don't have a strict diet of anything. As a diabetic, I try to be a good diabetic. As an athlete, I know that I need certain things. But if I can choose between organic and not organic, I'm going to buy the organic. Like there's all the little micro healthy decisions begin to add up and add up. And so honestly, it's not like I still learn things today. I mean, we're on year 7 right now, and there's going to be changes and things that I will learn in the next couple of days, weeks, or maybe even in the next 45 minutes that I'll begin to adopt into my life.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that keeps triathletes engaged, is because it's an ongoing learning process. You're never, even though you cross a finish line, there's always something to learn. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I always feel as I'm completely engaged, because every race there's something new, and every race keeps me wanting to do better in some capacity. And I love the in-between parts, the training for each event. And I'm not all that savvy with the Spartan races. So maybe you can just take a moment just to kind of tell us what I know it has something to do with obstacle courses, and some of the obstacles look a little more extreme than others, but maybe you could just tell us what a Spartan race consists of.
Sure. Absolutely. There's a lot of obstacle course racing brands out there. I talk about Spartan the most because that's where my story begins, and that's where I spend the most time in. But an obstacle course race is it's essentially a trail run with human being manufactured adversity out on the course. Spartan does a tremendous job of actually using the terrain as much as possible. Like, they will make it a very difficult course without obstacles. So race distances range from anywhere from 5K to 50K. I like to run them all. I like the longer distances myself. But within that distance, there's going to be anywhere from 20 to 30 obstacles. When you run the 50K, it's actually 60 obstacles. But obstacles include, like you said, some are more extreme than others. Some are just kind of hopping over a 4-foot wall. Some are climbing over an 8-foot wall. A lot of them are climbing a 15-foot rope. There's a lot of functional fitness type of obstacles, carrying a 60-pound sandbag, doing sled drags, and deadlifting heavy balls. And there's even a unique obstacle, throwing a spear. And then, of course, a number of overhead rigs like monkey bars, rings, stuff like that. But they're slippery, and they also modify them in different ways. Spartan does a really good job of trying to test everything. We talk about multi-sport, right? Like, they literally tell you got to train for everything. I mean, they're not putting you on a bike out there, but sometimes you are swimming too.
So it's really a combination of endurance and strength, because it sounds like a lot of strength activities involved in those obstacles.
I'm going to say functional strength, though, too. There are, if you were to take somebody out of a CrossFit gym who's never run, and if you were to take a runner who's never lifted and put them in that same race, the runner is going to win by a lot because it's a race and there's a lot of running. That said, obstacle proficiency matters, and you don't need to be able to do 100 pull-ups to do one of these races well, but you should probably be able to do 5.
Yeah. And just for my education, training for these races involves training, like what the obstacles are, so you can train for the obstacles?
Yes and no. Back in the day, before everybody was just living on social media, they actually would try to hide some of the obstacles, so there was this element of surprise. But Spartan has been one of the drivers of trying to get obstacle course racing into the Olympics, which is appearing as a modern day decathlon. And so they really started standardizing their races and standardizing obstacles. So nowadays, yes, you kind of know what they are. That said, you train the functional fitness required for the obstacle. If you spend a lot of time practicing for an obstacle, there's a good chance that obstacle is not going to be there that day, or it's going to be modified in some other capacity. So.
Got it. And then you've also gone on to do some marathons and ultras. Tell me about what got you to step up the distances and how you have enjoyed doing those kinds of events as opposed to the sort of purer kind of strength and obstacle races.
Well, much like triathlon, marathon was a 4-letter word to me. I never could have comprehended me running that distance. Just the idea of running for so long just seemed impossible to me. And I didn't understand this concept of easy running and slow running. I just run, and it just seemed so miserable. And the marathon bombing in 2013, even when I was still drinking, even before I was running, even before anything, was the first time I got it in my head that I wanted to run the Boston Marathon. Like I said, I grew up there. It's my backyard. I'd been in the marathon a dozen times. And I think probably like a lot of people that day, I felt like I wanted to do something. I needed to do something. I just didn't know what. And what better way to punch back than showing up? And so that was sort of what planted in my head in the first place. And then I actually saw the movie that had come out, Patriots Day. I saw that, and it was around 2017. And then a friend of mine reached out and he goes, "Hey, let's run the Chicago Marathon together." And I'm like, "You know what? All right, we'll start there. I'll do this. I'm going to train for Chicago." And about a month after that, I was in a car accident, which is where I got 4 more of my 7 herniated discs. And I saw everything being taken away from me. I had been at this only for about 6 or 7 or 8 months now. And I had just experienced a psychic change. Like, I was already looking at the world differently, and people were reacting to me differently. And so I just felt good about who I was becoming. And then all of a sudden, I got nerve damage from the accident. I got more herniated discs. I couldn't get answers on the nerve damage. And I just saw this all being taken away from me. And I had this moment of defiance where I was like, you know what? And this is what I realized too. Before obstacle course racing, and even before this moment, I had not overcome my adversity. I had not overcome the things that had happened to me. I had only survived them. It was in this moment where I said, I'm not going to be a victim. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to be a survivor anymore either, because a survivor implies that I have been victimized, and I am not a victim. No, I am going to thrive. It was a declaration. And one of the very first things I did since I couldn't run Chicago, I said, well, that's it. I need to run Boston. How do I do that? Knowing that had never run a marathon before, I had no ability to qualify. And the Boston Marathon is one of the hardest marathons, one of the hardest races to get into, period. And so I just began reaching out to friends and I was led to the Boston Charity Teams organization, which raises money for Boston charities. And that's one of the ways that you can get a bib for the Boston Marathon. And so I connected with a group called the Last Call Foundation, who raises money for local Boston firehouses, new equipment, education, etc. My dad was a retired firefighter who was actually injured in the line. And I thought it was a good charity to sign up with. So I raised $10,000 and ran my first marathon.
So sport has obviously been a huge driver for your mental and physical well-being. It obviously had a huge impact on just giving you purpose and helping you find focus for a lot of the outlets that previously you were casting about. And I think a lot was poured into drinking and addiction. How do you help other people find the same kind of solace, the same kind of purpose? Not everybody is going to be able to do Spartan races or marathons. I mean, I encounter this all the time. Not everybody is able. I mean, everybody is able to, barring some kind of physical disability, most people are able to just get up and at least start walking. But not everybody has that motivation to do a Spartan race or is going to feel the same connection that you and I feel to these kinds of long distance endurance sports. So how do you help people who you see struggling with similar kinds of issues related either to addiction or just this casting about because they are self-destructive and for whatever reason? I know that you speak. I know that you have a website. I know that you do a lot of outreach. What is your message to people to try and help them find the same kind of purpose that you have?
First is this, which I will debate that not everybody can. And I'll say this because we all have our own frame of reference. We all have our own starting line. I run in the competitive division, but I am not competitive, right? Like, nobody's worried about me stealing their podium that day. And part of the reason that I run in the competitive division is so that I can show other diabetics that they can compete, that we are on the same stage as everyone else. We're not asking for a level playing field. And so I like to show rather than just do or say. But the thing about Spartan Race, for example, is they have the competitive division and they also have an open division, which is for anyone to compete against themselves. And there are teams out there full of adaptive athletes that help adaptive athletes throughout the course, which is why I can say that anybody can do it. I mean, there is no better point in the race for me when I'm 26 miles into a 31 mile race and I'm seeing unicorns riding donkeys or something and I'm completely upside down. I think I can't go on. And I see the guy with one leg up ahead of me carrying his sandbag. And I go, you know what? Shut up. Yes, I can. But that said, it doesn't always have to be an obstacle course or a triathlon. You mentioned about getting up and walking around the block for 5 minutes. That I'm constantly putting out these daily social motivational videos on all my channels. And I'm not talking to the athlete most of the time. I'm trying to talk to the person who's on the couch who wants to make a change in their life and encouraging them to make that first change, that incremental step into the uncomfortable. If they just continue to live in that comfort zone, it becomes a prison cell that they can't get out of. So if somebody's not moving, yeah, let's just take a 5 minute walk around the block if it's more than we're doing now. I lost 40 pounds before I even heard of Spartan Race. 40 pounds. I didn't go on a diet. I didn't do some sort of crazy workout plan. I managed my macros and I kept track of my activity throughout the day. Change is just a series of small, healthy, positive decisions towards a bigger goal.
I like that a lot. I like that little statement you just made there at the end, because I think that is the basis of everything is just, first of all, making the decision to make the change and then just taking small steps, because small steps add up. We always talk about incremental things. What's next for you, Nick? I mean, you've done a lot. You've been able to accomplish a lot of things. First of all, are we going to see you out on a triathlon course? And second of all, what is next for you?
All right. Well, let me tell you this real quick. I mentioned that triathlon was a four-letter word to me, like marathon was. And I said how change happens with small decisions, right? Dude, I live in Florida. I have a pool. Like, there's no reason I can't train for a triathlon, but I've never been in just, I always said no, no, no. But last year I bought a bike. And all of a sudden I'm like, well, maybe I will do one day. So the small changes just open doors. Like, that's it. The small changes open doors. So will I do one? Probably. As I'm focused on my motivational speaking career, like, I need to invest my time and money into that right now, which means I can't be on a plane every week for a Spartan race. So I need to take advantage of more of the things that are local to me. And there's triathlons year round. I mean, I live 10 minutes from the ocean. So that said, it's not going to be this year. Probably not. I am heavily focused on the Spartan brand. And there is one race that I have been after for a while, which is a 31-mile obstacle race, about 60 obstacles, maybe 16 or 17,000 feet of elevation. It's in Killington, Vermont, and I am 0 for 2 in that race. So that is the goal this year. That is number one.
Well, those kinds of challenges definitely keep you getting up and keep you training, right? So it's good to have that kind of thing. And what is that race called?
It's a Spartan race, a Spartan Ultra.
All right. Well, I will be watching to see how that works out for you. And are you going for that one again this year?
Yeah. This is the year.
All right. Well, I'll wish you the best of luck for that. Well, Nick, I can't thank you enough for coming onto the podcast and sharing your story and sharing your enthusiasm for obstacle course racing and just for fitness in general. And I love the whole attitude that anyone can do anything. They just need to make small changes to start, and then it goes from there. Nick Klingensmith is a motivational speaker. He's an obstacle course racer. He is a multiple cancer survivor, a type 1 diabetic. He's really just got an incredible resume. I'm going to include all of his social media links in the show notes. I hope that you will check him out because he really is a fascinating person. Nick, thanks again for joining me today. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for another episode. The TriDoc Podcast is produced and edited by me, Jeff Sankoff, along with my interns.
I'm Agent Johnson. This is Special Agent Johnson.
Oh, how you doing?
No relation.
I'm Jeff Sankoff, the TriDoc. I'm in charge here.
Not anymore.
Those interns are Ian Johnson and Ben Johnson. You can find the show notes for everything discussed on the show today, as well as archives of previous episodes at TriDocPodcast.com. Do you have questions about any of the issues discussed on this episode, or do you have a question that you'd like for me to consider answering on a future episode? Send me an email at tri_doc@icloud.com, or join the private TriDoc Podcast Facebook group on Facebook, and you can submit your questions there. If you're interested in coaching services, please visit tridoccoaching.com or lifesportcoaching.com, where you can find a lot of information about me and the services that I provide. You can also follow me on the TriDoc Podcast Facebook page, TriDoc Coaching on Instagram, and the TriDoc Coaching YouTube channel. If you enjoy this podcast, I hope that you'll consider leaving me a rating and a review, as well as subscribe to the show wherever you download it. And of course, there's always the option of becoming a supporter of the podcast at patreon.com/TriDocPodcast. The music heard at the beginning and the end of the show is Radio by Empty Hours and is used with permission. This song and many others like it can be found at ReverbNation.com, where I hope that you'll visit and give small independent bands a chance. The TriDoc Podcast will be back again soon with another medical question for me to answer and another interview with someone in the world of multisport. Until then, remember 1121 and train hard, train healthy.